The very latest from our local ag industry. The Farming Show with Dylan Honkoop is next on KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM and KGMI.com.
Lummi Bay Market at Exit 260 is where you'll find more in the store. You'll find more in the store because there's so much store. Almost 10,000 square feet. The Lummi Bay Market is where you'll find everything you need for on and off the road. You'll find the best value on gas and diesel, along with way more than you would expect out of a convenience store. There's a liquor department featuring a great selection of your favorite competitively priced spirits, wines, and mixers. And of course, you'll want to check out the huge selection of ice-cold beer in their massive beer cave. Want to grab a quick bite for breakfast or lunch? Don't feel like cooking dinner? At the Lummi Bay Market, you'll find a great hot deli counter, including our brand new fried chicken tenders, and chicken wings with all the fixins. Make the Lummi Bay Market your first or last stop of the day for fuel, food, and more. The Lummi Bay Market, just off I-5 at Exit 260 on Rural Avenue. Open 24 hours, 7 days a week. Lummi Bay Market, where there's more in the store.
Get ready to roll the dice for a chance at $100,000 in cash. That's right. For our 22nd anniversary on April 27th, we're giving 30 lucky winners a chance at over $100,000 in cash and other prizes. Claim one free daily entry. Play our free online game at silverreef.erewards.com to win even more entries. The results are in, and you voted us best casino and best steak in the Northwest. Thank you all for your support. Silver Reef Casino Resort, located off I-5, exit 260. We've got that.
What does your dream getaway have? Luxury hotel rooms, elegant suites, and relaxing spa? We've got that. World-class Wine Spectator Award-winning steakhouse? We've got that. Washington's premier golf destination? We've got that. How about the newest slots, table games, and exciting promotions? Oh yeah, we've got those too. Visit Silver Reef Casino Resort and hit the getaway jackpot. Silver Reef Casino Resort, located off I-5, exit 260. We've got that.
Bugs. They can be a problem, can they not? Well, a little bit more troublesome than your house flies and your spiders and even, you know, aphids and other bugs that we deal with in agriculture. There is a threat to agriculture in Washington State from a bug, a new not so invited guest in our region is could potentially wreak havoc for farming here in Washington State. Welcome to the Farming Show. Dylan Honkoop here on KGMI. Glad you're here on this Saturday morning, bright and early. And we got to talk about bugs today. You know, it's not always our favorite thing to talk about, but people need to be aware of what's going on. Over on the east side is kind of the epicenter for the concerns about this. What's the bug? It's Japanese beetles. Invasive Japanese beetles. And to be honest, I don't know anything about Japanese beetles, but we're going to bring on an expert. She joins us now, Cassie Chehorse with WSDA, with the Washington State Department of Agriculture. She's an outreach specialist there. Cassie, thanks for joining us on the program this morning. So I guess just to get started, so people are aware, we can talk about what the bugs are like and what you guys are doing, but what's the big concern right at this point? What kind of damage could we be facing from this invasive species?
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me. So Japanese beetle, right, it's a new emerging pest in Washington. We've actually been looking for it in Washington since the 90s, making sure it's not here, et cetera. And a few years ago, we found Japanese beetle in the lower valley. Since then, we've been working on like a multi-year eradication to trap for the beetles, treat for them, and remove them. Because as you mentioned, they cause problems. It could affect agriculture. It's going to affect people in their backyards.
Okay, so for farming, what do they do? Chew on crops?
Right, so the beetle itself specifically, it has different life stages, right? It's an egg and a larva or a grub and then an adult. When it's in that adult stage, we'll see it in the summer and it'll fly around and it likes green leafy material. It'll chew those leaves, and it also likes buds of flowers, right? So if you're a farmer, it eats over 300 different types of crops. Specifically in the lower valley, it really likes hops and it likes grape leaves. So that's some of the main things farmed in there. It can get up in tree canopies and it skeletonizes those leaves. With really intense feeding after years, it could reduce those yields and cause other problems for farmers. Aside from just them eating it, there's also quarantines and pesticide uses that could become problems for farmers and agriculture as well.
Yeah. So what has the, you say again, the lower valley, the Yakima Valley over there in eastern Washington is where they've been finding these Japanese beetles. That's the invasive species we're talking about right now. How much damage have they been causing already? Have growers of, you know, our famous Washington wines and hops and tree fruit and all those other things, have they been reporting significant damage from this yet?
So when we think about Japanese beetle and its life stage, right, we talked about those adults. The next thing we need to think about is its grubs or its larva.
Yeah.
What it looks like before it becomes the adult. Now, these favor grass roots, and that's like our lawn, like our ornamental grasses, turf, what you have in your front and backyard. And I mean, if you look at your lawn, it's lots of grass. It's just a giant buffet for these beetles, for their little grubs. So they're going to be really intense in areas where we have parks, where you have your schools, your churches, and all your lawns. So we're going to see most of the beetles in those residential areas. And that's where we're going to see the most destruction caused in our lawns. However, then they will hatch into those adults and they're going to eat whatever's nearby. And they're going to spread themselves out, whether we help transport them or they're flying themselves. And then they're going to get into those canopies in those agricultural areas and cause the feeding and the effects of the farmers.
So, yeah, you talk about grass. Well, of course, in Yakima Valley and over here in Western Washington, too, we have a lot of dairy farming. Dairy farming relies on corn and grass, amongst a few other things, for primary, you know, feed. They make milk out of grass and corn. So is this going to get into agricultural grass fields and destroy crops of silage? I remember over here in Western Washington a few years ago, my cousin was working as an agronomist at the time, and we had him on the program here to talk about it. There was kind of an outbreak for a year or two of a whole bunch of armyworms. So similar kind of thing, a bunch of grubs. And at that time, I captured video of them just chewing away on blades of grass out in fields, and you could see these big fields of grass for forage just decimated from these little grubs, from those little caterpillar worms.
Yeah. So one thing to note about grubs, especially these grubs, is they're hard to tell apart from other grubs. It's just a typical white C-shaped grub with a brown tan head and visible legs. But in terms of grass, if you think like ornamental vegetation, it's going to be not our native tall fescue or hay grasses. It's going to be stuff in people's yards. So that's kind of a good thing.
Yeah, that's good.
But corn, right? Those corn husks, you know, they could get into it and they could feed on it. But more importantly, it's probably potentially one of their modes of travel and a way they could get transported. So in areas where Japanese beetles are feeding, and things that they're feeding on, those items, including like your grass clippings, those movements could get restricted if you're in an area of Japanese beetle, and that could feel an effect that a farmer or a landowner might feel.
So they're not as much of a threat to like field grasses, but they love lawn grasses.
They do. And then if you think about it, if you're in your yard and you have all these yummy grubs in it, you're going to have other critters and rodents come in and pull those grubs up and make a bigger mess, right?
Fun.
And then your lawn, it's just never going to turn green. You're going to have yellow patches. We get a nice rain, you're going to have mud. kids bringing it in, your animals bringing it in.
Well, then from a bigger, and by the way, we're talking with Cassie Chehorse right now. She's an outreach specialist with the Washington State Department of Agriculture, talking about invasive Japanese beetles that have reared their ugly head over in the eastern, in the lower valley, Yakima Valley in eastern Washington. A problem for agriculture and a problem for residents with lawns, as we're hearing now. It sounds like from a higher level, you know, lawns and residential areas with things that these bugs like can kind of create a reservoir then for this pest that I would imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, can then, you know, once the grubs who like the lawns mature, then they can get, you know, get moving and the adults can spread out from there. So the farmers nearby aren't going to be so happy that lawns and residential areas are harboring this pest that can then go chew on their crops.
Yeah, we found them in Yakima, Benton, and Franklin counties, you know, so that's definitely true. And those grubs that are living in those lawns, right, those adults hatch up, they eat leaves and stuff, but also while they're eating, they're mating and they're dropping their eggs. So whatever they're eating on, they're just going to drop below and drop their eggs. And if you have like a potted plant outside and those beetles drop their eggs in it and you move your potted plant, you know, you can be moving beetles too. So there's lots of ways the beetles can get spread around and find more buffets and more agriculture and different things to eat.
So now what's the risk over here in Western Washington? Is this just going to be an Eastern Washington thing? Are they going to make their way over there? Have they already maybe snuck over here?
Nope, they're currently just in Yakima, Benton, and Franklin counties. When we first started trapping Japanese beetle, we had a population a little over 23,000 beetles. Since then, we've decreased it down to over 19,655 beetles as of last year. So to get rid of the beetles, it's going to be a trapping, treating, and quarantine process. By trapping for the beetles, we can see where they are. So we set traps all across Washington State to monitor for the beetles and to see if they're spreading. Now, in those areas where we're catching the beetles, when we set the traps, it's helping catch those adults so they can't lay as many eggs. And then we treat for the beetles to help remove them. And then that quarantine is how we help prevent them from moving. Basically, we take the area that the beetles are in and create a boundary around it. We've set traps so we know where the beetles are. And then everything that's inside that boundary, if it can spread beetles, we work with residents and we work with growers to help mitigate those risks. So they can move things outside or they can treat things and move things outside, but they're trying to keep those beetles in that area so we have the area to treat.
Right.
So right now, just the lower valley, but we do keep tabs on the rest of Washington and help work to keep them just in that area.
So it could be possible for somebody to get something from that area that has eggs or grubs or, I suppose, adult beetles in it. And that could be transported if someone isn't paying attention to the quarantine. And that could end up over here in Western Washington.
It's a possibility that could happen. Japanese beetle is also living in the east coast of the United States, right? So people could move from there or buy things and potentially transport it over here if they're not following different rules and regulations as well.
I think about this in terms of farm products, and you know, a lot of people will buy hay and different grass crops and other things for feed here in Western Washington from Eastern Washington. Is there a risk in that? I guess growers in a quarantine area will know that they can't sell those kinds of crops to over here.
If you remember, like our feed hay and our grasses like that, they're not going to harbor the beetle. And then if you think about how they are mechanically baled and smushed together, no beetle's going to make it through that process. Okay. So
we're good
to transport hay in and out. It's just like if you live there, you cut your grass, you don't want to move those grass clippings.
So, okay. And again, this is the Farming Show here on KGMI, News Talk 790, 96.5 FM in Bellingham. I'm Dylan Honkoop, your host this hour, and Cassie Chehorse is with us right now. She's with WSDA talking about these invasive Japanese beetles. You're putting me at least at somewhat at ease that they can't be transported, say, in hay or grass crops, and that they don't like farm, you know, field grass, forage grasses. That's huge, because I figured if they like lawns, they would like big, you know, orchard grass, fescues, other things like that. Triticale, I don't know if they like that.
I mean, like, you do have to be a little careful with your mixes, but the reality of if someone's haying a field, that mechanical bill, the hay is going to be fine.
What if it's a silage bale? And I don't know if people transport silage bales from the east side over here so much as dry hay. I couldn't tell you on that, but I would imagine the ensilement, what's the right word? Ensiling process would kill any bugs in, say, like a wrapped bale as well.
Yeah, think about it along the same kind of coincidence as compost, right? If we compost right. in our backyard, it's not typically like heated up enough, right? And it yeah. could be soily. That might move Japanese beetle, but like a dairy farm, a composting facility like that, you know, they're going to heat it up and mix things around before they move them. So like dairy manure wouldn't be at risk to move, dairy compost would not be at risk to move Japanese beetle versus your backyard compost potentially could be.
Yeah. Well, and I'm wondering, I guess you talk about treating for it, and it sounds like probably the best place to treat is residential areas where these things like to hang out and grow up before they spread out into ag areas. Is that something then homeowners need to be doing? They need to be treating their lawns in those areas so this doesn't become a big problem and start spreading across the state?
Yeah, they do. But the cool thing about this is, you know, we have this multi-year eradication, right? Our right. chance to get rid of them, and treatment is part of our steps. Mm-hmm. So we actually go into residential areas and treat people's lawns for free. We send them out a mailer, right? We send them out a mail and ask for their consent to enter their property in the spring, and we'll actually treat them for free. So it's treatment's free to the landowner. We come in and do it for them.
Makes a lot of sense because it benefits everybody. I mean, I could see someone being like, I don't want to sink money into treating my lawn. Maybe I don't care that much about my lawn, but nearby agriculture sure as heck cares if these beetles start to explode because people aren't treating for them.
Right. So it's a big project. It's a lot of cooperation between landowners and agriculture combined, kind of to reach this like common goal of getting it out of Washington. That way we can operate freely and we don't have to live with this pest, the long-term pesticide use, and the regulatory effects we could potentially have.
Yeah. You guys at Washington State Department of Ag think, you know, are you optimistic that we can get rid of this thing entirely and it would be gone?
I would say, yeah, we're optimistic. I mean, our numbers have decreased greatly, and we do have neighboring states who have success stories. So in Oregon, they started off with a population of around 20,000. They've been going on to multiple years, and I believe they were sitting at 4 or 6 the last I heard. Hmm. And if you turn and look at Idaho, they have a huge success story in Boise. It took them about 6 years, but they went down to 0. And they have beetles pop up in pockets of Caldwell and Pocatello, and they've also been able to remove and treat. So our neighboring states have done it. We're continuing the process. Our numbers are going down, and we'll hopefully just continue that role of working with the landowners and the farmers to, you know, completely yeah. remove Japanese beetle.
Well, I hope you guys are successful and can contain it and keep it there and it doesn't spread. And certainly it doesn't end up over here. Selfishly, I'm sorry for those folks who have to deal with it over in the lower Yakima Valley. Cassie Chehorse with us right now with the Washington State Department of Agriculture. What else? I mean, do you just deal with bugs or what all do you
yeah,
do there so with WSDA?
I do outreach some for this state. A lot of it's with the pest program. So I go around and I meet with people, landowners, residents, and different groups and teach them about some of the emerging pests or potentially some of the problems they could have in their backyard. And the greatest tool that I can give them is to let them know how they can help. So, for example, if you are just someone listening in and you ever happen to see Japanese beetle or think you see it, there's one very important thing that you can do. And what do you think that is?
I don't know. Call, email, something like that and say, hey, right. guys.
But before you do any of that, I always remind people to try to do one thing.
Capture the bug.
Before you capture it, I want you to take a picture.
All right. Yeah, there you go. Shoot it with a camera.
Yep.
And everybody has a camera in their phone in their pocket now, so that can happen.
Right. If you try to catch it, it might fly off. And pictures are the best way that we can have evidence and we can have proof so that we can act and we can do something, follow up with you and work. So that's kind of what I do in a nutshell. I'm available as a resource to the public, to groups, basically anybody who needs some help or wants some education. That's kind of what my job is.
Okay, so if I see one, and I hope I don't over here in Western Washington, but if somebody sees one or what they think could be one, and you can probably Google this up, too, if you want to get images of a Japanese beetle so you know what we're talking about. And also remembering that there are three different life stages. I don't know. Are the eggs tiny? Can you even see those?
I mean, I think it's just easiest to think of grubs and adults. Yeah, and the grubs, you're going to have to dig into the soil. Grubs look the same. So I would focus on looking for the adults in the summer.
And do they have identifying marks on them?
Yeah, so it's about the size of your pinky nail. It is a green metallic-y beetle with copper wing covers. Okay. And again, you're going to see them in the summer. If you see it, snap it, send it. You can report a couple different ways, but the easiest way is to go online to agr.wa.gov/beetles and upload your photo. You can also email pestprogram@agr.wa.gov. or call our 800 hotline. And that's just the simplest, easiest thing you can do. Half of our reports on invasive species come from the public, right? And that half of our reports come from trapping, whether that's working with animals, plants, and insects. So the public plays a large role in helping protect Washington. That's why we're trying to educate and have everybody work together.
Perfect. Well, thank you for all the information and thanks for the work that you guys are doing to contain this. Some people may say, well, you know, is it how big of a deal is it? But it's better to nip this in the bud before it explodes because, well, it sounds like it's been a real headache for folks back on the East Coast where they have bigger populations of these things.
Cool. Well, I appreciate your time and for having me, and I hope we don't see the beetles in other areas, but everybody should keep their eyes open.
Yeah, fingers crossed for that. Cassie Chehorse with the Washington State Department of Agriculture. We appreciate your time this morning.
Now you can mow, dig, grade, haul, and more with the perfect solution for your property, a Branson tractor. Save your back and your wallet with one of our compact but powerful tractors here at Farmers Equipment Company. Stop by and choose from our full line of Bransons to take on your toughest tasks. With tractors from 19 to 55 horsepower, we have a Branson compact or utility tractor that is perfect for you. Want to use a rotary cutter to tame that tall brush on your property? You can do that. What about snagging a scoop from that pile of gravel to maintain your driveway free of potholes? You can do that too. Branson's 6-year warranty, along with our factory-trained technicians, will make sure your new tractor is always running great. Get the tractor you want and the peace of mind you need at Farmers Equipment Company. To learn more, visit us online at farmersequip.com or stop by our locations in Linden or Burlington today. Farmers Equipment Company, serving the Pacific Northwest for over 86 years.
The Mill at 7th, Linden's hidden jewel of a restaurant on Front Street. You'll find comfortable dining, top shelf service with consistently delicious food. If you haven't experienced The Mill, it's time to visit.
Hi, I'm Linda, owner of The Mill at 7th. I want to invite you to come dine with us. Our staff and I have worked hard to create an atmosphere that provides you with a welcoming experience with fresh, enticing foods, cocktails, and a wonderfully unique selection of wines.
Listen to what our customers have to say. CJ says,
we love to eat here. Plan on spending some relaxing time in an environment that's warm and inviting. The staff is so sweet and the food is so yummy.
Ashley says,
The Mill is one of my go-to dinner spots. The food and atmosphere are always exceptional and the service can't be beat. If you want an amazing appetizer, get the apple crostini. You won't be disappointed.
Stop by The Mill today for an exceptional date night experience. Group parties and catering options at The Mill at 7th, downtown Linden on Front Street under the windmill.
When you buy a Subaru from Dewey Griffin, you're buying more than a vehicle. You're buying safety for your family, an investment that will hold its value, and reliability that will last a long, long time. Simply put, you're buying trust. Stop by Dewey today and check out their huge inventory of 2024 Subarus, from the 8-passenger Ascent to the Outback, Forester, and the sporty Impreza, and the all-new Crosstrek. Dewey Griffin Subaru. Community-minded, community-driven, and the only Subaru-certified tire and service center in Whatcom County.
The latest local news and important topics of the day from the West Mechanical Studio.
Rest easy in a cool home this summer. Contact West Mechanical Heating, Air Conditioning, and Electrical to add AC to your existing system for as little as $140 a month. Find them at westmechanical.net.
Get the latest news and information 24/7 with KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM Bellingham. Streaming live at mybellinghamnow.com.
The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KGMI or the Cascade Radio Group.
Okay, so water rights lawsuit. It's coming. Right? We've been talking about this a lot. What do you have to do? What are you going to have to do to be prepared for this? Of course, we talked about the event that we had a couple of weeks ago in Linden. I know not everyone could make that, but at least we had it in the evening so more people could. We had close to 400 people there at the Northwest Washington Fairground. People wanting to know, goodness, what am I going to do when I, apparently this summer or now maybe later than that, maybe in the fall, I don't know how quickly this process is going to move, but apparently sometime this year, yet we all basically, all of us out in the county anyway, are going to receive court summons in the mail that says essentially we have to defend our right to access the water that we have access to. How is this going? What do we have to be prepared for? And as it turns out, the state doesn't even have things fully decided yet as far as what is the form that you're going to have to fill out to say, yeah, I want to defend my water rights. Here's what I have about my water rights. These are the pertinent details that I'm going to file with the court so I can have a case, so I can have standing in this court case that's happening. Welcome to the Farming Show. This is Dylan Honkoop here on KGMI. Of course, farmers are thinking a lot about this. And if you are a farmer and you aren't thinking about this and you irrigate at all, or you have animals that drink water, or you use water for any other purpose whatsoever, you need to be thinking about this and tuned into this process. And joining us right now is an expert on all of this with some of the details on problems that we here at Whatcom Family Farmers, which is where I work, have raised, you know, red flags about. There are some issues with what the state is planning to do and some things that they need to fix before they send mail out to you and forms that you need to fill out. Joining us with details on that is Bill Clark. He's a water rights attorney as well as a government affairs expert, knows a ton about the policy side of this, the legal parts of this. And Bill, there's a lot still to come on this, but the more we find out, the more questions it seems come up with all of this. And there are some big questions that need to be answered by the state right now, correct?
That's right, Dylan. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. And I think as we get closer to the date when the Department of Ecology will file this lawsuit in Whatcom County, there are a lot of questions about the claim forms themselves, which is the document that any farmer or any rural homeowner with their own well will have to file in Superior Court to become a party to the lawsuit in order to establish their legal right to continue water use. So it's really we've seen drafts of these adjudication claim forms, as they're called, and that's what's raised a lot of questions about what people need to do to prepare for this lawsuit.
And I think it was you that we were talking with this past fall right here on the show when you said, look, if you don't file one of these claims, when you get the court summons, you know, if you're an agricultural water user, or if you have a private well, even just for your home, and you get the summons in the mail, which you are going to get, I guess the people who live in cities or on water associations may not get them, even though the heads of the water associations and certainly the heads of the cities, you know, the administrative folks will all have to be dealing with this. But in terms of just regular individuals, you know, I'm on an exempt well at my house, so I anticipate getting something. There are thousands and thousands of people who will be getting these things in the mail. And it was you that told us this fall, look, if you don't do anything, even if you have all of your ducks in a row, you have all the legal water rights, all the right paperwork, all the right documentation, which is a lot of stuff. Even if you have all of that and don't do anything, you will lose your water, correct?
That's right. Yeah, and that's your distinction's correct. If you live in the city of Linden and you get water from the city of Linden's utility or Everson or Bellingham, if they're your water utility, then you as the homeowner don't need to file anything. The city will file an adjudication claim for the city's water rights. But even if you're a homeowner that has your own well that serves just your one house, you will need to participate in this case by filing the adjudication claim form. And like you said, many folks are on like a water association or a shared well or things like that. If you have group water uses like that, you'll have to figure out who within that group is going to file the adjudication claim forms. But that's how the process will go.
And again, if you don't do anything, you will lose the water that you currently have access to. That's the important part. And, you know, this may cost individuals a lot. And then, you know, since we are mentioning the municipal water users and the water association water users, there will be legal bills associated with this, and you will pay through either your tax rates, your water rates, what you pay to your water associations. That will be an additional cost as the powers that be defend your access to water on your behalf if you are part of one of those systems. But I think more to the point of our conversation today is, you know, individuals who are going to be getting this mail and having to fill out forms, there are issues with some of the forms that we have raised. First, though, Bill, talk about what are the different pieces of paperwork that people are going to see, that they're going to have to fill out, that they need to be ready for.
Right. So the adjudication process is driven by state law. And so state law has a statute that says here's what must be in the adjudication claim form. It's RCW 90-03-140. And that's been in place for a number of years. Last year in the 2023 legislative session, there was a piece of legislation that passed. It was sponsored by Representative Joe Timmons, who's from the 42nd District. That one of the parts of that bill requires that Ecology at least provide draft claims forms for public review so people can start to see what their filing requirements will be and what kind of information they need to get together to file in court. And so under that bill now, we've at least seen the drafts of these claim forms in a draft instructions document. So there are kind of three documents that Department of Ecology has issued for review and public comment. One are the instructions on the claim forms. Secondly is what is generally being called the small use claims form. And that's for a well serving a single house that uses less than 500 gallons per day for indoor domestic use and less than 1/2 acre outside lawn and garden. So the small use claim form is less than 500 gallons per day maximum and less than 1/2 acre lawn or garden outside. That use can be included in a small use claim form, which is about 6 pages long. Then there's the full use claim form or the long claim form for any other water use. So that would be irrigation above 1/2 acre, which is above the exemption limit. So you'd have a permit or a certificate or a pre-existing water right claim for that. Any stock water use, municipal use, things like that. Larger water rights would use the full claims form. So those are the three documents that have been issued so far.
I'm worried to ask this, but you said the short, the streamlined, the quote unquote easy claim form for the smaller uses is 6 pages. How long is the big one?
It's about 10 pages.
Okay.
So it's, wow. You know, the short one is not much shorter than the long one. And I know There are about 25 comment letters submitted to Ecology in response to these draft forms. Some of the comment letters raised this question of the statute doesn't say that there would be two forms, and it's unclear whether or not a college has the authority to have separate claim forms for different uses, right? Because again, you're all part of the same lawsuit. And I think there's a point to be made that if you just have a single form, it might be easier, frankly, than saying, well, if you have this water use, you use this form and there's less information. And if you use the longer form, there's more information. It might be simpler just to have one form, frankly. The question has been raised, and I know the state attorney general's office will have to deal with it, is does ecology have the authority to use different forms for different types of water use? I think that question's is out there.
Yeah, because it puts people in different categories when this is supposed to be a legal process, with kind of equal opportunity or lack thereof, whatever we want to call it. Deciding apparently arbitrarily which water users have an easier versus a more complicated process to file for this. Now, if you do the quote unquote streamlines, the simpler form, and like you said, you just have a home and up to a half acre of irrigation, which is interesting to me because there's no simplified process for a half acre or any amount of acreage whatsoever for a farmer that, you know, if they have any irrigation, they have to do the full meal deal. But if you do the simplified process, you're limited to 500 gallons a day, or is that just for the house? And then what about the irrigation element for irrigating a garden? That's where I'm starting to question, you know, why wouldn't I just want to have a house and irrigate a garden as opposed to, you know, this whole farming thing?
Yeah, I mean, and that question was raised in a number of comment letters, which is the water code, the statute itself, directs ecology that it should provide information to assist small uses of water, right? So claimants who have small uses of water will get assistance from ecology. The statute doesn't say that there are different claim forms or different standards of proof of your water use. And so one issue that has been raised that I think the Attorney General's office, and at some point after the adjudication is filed, I think the Superior Court will have to deal with, is as proposed by ecology for the small use claim form, if you use less than 500 gallons per day for indoor domestic use, right? That's your kitchen, your bathrooms, showers, laundry, et cetera. If you stay under 500 gallons per day and up to a half acre lawn or garden outside, you don't have to prove your water use. You don't have to establish like how much and prove your actual water use through the years, which is a different standard than what will be applied to irrigation water rights. If you have a normal commercial farming operation, you will have to prove your actual water use. And so if you look at the number of potential homeowners with outdoor water use, you know, that could be thousands of acre feet of water that would go through the adjudication process without really quantifying the use. That's really helpful to those homeowners. Then again, to other water right holders, they have a much higher standard of proof. So is it fair to them? Not really.
Well, and basically what it's saying is if you farm that land, you're going to have to go through the full process of proving your water use and why you should have access to it. And you may not get that. You may not get sufficient or any water depending on how you file and what the process ends up giving you or not. Versus if you instead take that land and develop it, it basically has water, I don't want to say guaranteed, but it's a lot more of a sure thing that there would be water then for running a home and irrigating gardens on the same ground that if you were just going to farm it, which I think a lot of people in this community would agree, we want to keep farming going. The farmer has a lot steeper hill to climb there.
Yeah, I think that's one of the ironies of this case is, you know, take a hypothetical farm. If that farm is ultimately found to not have water rights, that land could be developed for housing and under ecology's regulation that regulates the Nooksack River and the Nooksack Basin, there is water available for rural housing to be built, 500 gallons per day per house. So that's kind of the irony here is you could not have any water for farming, but you will have water for future housing use, which is not what people want to see happen in the farming areas around Linden and the rest of Whatcom County.
Well, for housing use and for irrigation, you know, this could be the same ground. If it's, you know, a half acre of irrigation, that half acre may not have been able to, you know, obviously not by itself, but lots of pieces of half acres all together in a big piece of farmland may not have been able to access any water, may not as a result of this process, but it would essentially say, again, that without having to prove water use, you could irrigate as a homeowner, but you couldn't irrigate as a farm. It sounds kind of crazy and it sounds unfair to me. Now, there is a challenge to this legally.
Well, and one thing I was going to note, too, because at the educational event in Linden last week, people asked, well, what's the basis for this half acre issue? And under the groundwater code, in Washington state, certain uses of water are exempt from needing to get a permit from the state of Washington. So one of those uses is single or group domestic use of up to 5,000 gallons per day, which now in the Nooksack Basin is limited to 500 gallons per day for new homes going forward. But another one of the exempt uses is a half acre non-commercial lawn or garden. And so under the groundwater code, a half acre non-commercial lawn or garden is exempt from the water rate permit requirement. Ecology is proposing to use that same half acre non-commercial lawn or garden threshold as the small use claim form limit.
So there have been concerns raised about this. As you said, a bunch of letters, a couple of dozen letters to the Attorney General's office saying, hey, this is not a fair process that's being proposed. What happens next with this?
Yeah, and so like a lot of the other kind of initial issues within the adjudication, you know, the adjudication is governed by the Whatcom County Superior Court. So there'll be a Whatcom County Superior Court judge that is assigned to this case after the lawsuit gets filed, which will probably be in April or May of this year. And the contents of the claim form ultimately will be determined through the court process before it is mailed out to all water users within the county with a summons, right? So again, it's think about it like a lawsuit. If you're a defendant in a lawsuit, you get a summons. You have to respond to the summons and file something in court to become a defendant. When that summons is issued, it will include the final claims form, and that's what people will have to fill out. There likely will be both an electronic option, meaning you can go online onto the Superior Court's website, file your claim form that way. You could also submit it and fill out a paper form and then mail it. And there probably will be both of those options, but ultimately that's the process. I think right now, I know that comments back to Department of Ecology have been referred to the Attorney General's office, which represents the state in legal proceedings. They'll review the comments and take those into account before they propose what will be the final claim forms and the final instructions document after the case is filed.
So we don't know if they're going to change this unfair element or not.
No, we don't know that yet. I think we do know at least what is in the statute that says here's what the claim forms must include. And so there's a list of information about, you know, the water rate number, the certificate number, the place of use, the purpose of use, the authorized quantity, things like that, the name of the claimant, the address, the county parcel number. Some of that information is known right now in terms of what will be in those claim forms, regardless of how some of these other issues get sorted out. And I should say this issue of the half acre lawn or garden is not the only issue that's been raised. There have been a number of other pretty interesting legal questions raised about the draft claim forms.
Oh, man, is this stuff complicated, is it not? I mean, I suppose this is your world, Bill, and you're an expert in it. We've been talking with Bill Clark, who's a water rights attorney and a government affairs specialist. You're used to this kind of stuff, but I think for a lot of us out here, we're feeling like, wow, this is overwhelming stuff.
Yeah, it's a very complicated, very arcane part of the law. And I think one of the big questions will be how will people be able to deal with this themselves as farmers, as homeowners? How many of them will need legal assistance, and many of them will, or technical assistance from water rights consultants and others? And, you know, I'd emphasize a couple other issues that have been raised with the draft claim forms. one of them deals with stock water. And again, stock water is, you know, water for dairies or cattle feeding operations, or even, you know, chickens, poultry, anything like that. The stock water issue, stock water is exempt from needing a water rate permit from the state. It's one of the four exempt uses in the groundwater code. Yep. And there have been cases through the years that kind of define what is this stock water exemption include, what is included within stock water. I think there are some pretty direct comment letters from Washington State Dairy Federation and the Washington Cattlemen's Association commenting that in Ecology's instructions, their description of what is the stock water exemption is inconsistent with some prior case law, in that if you read Ecology's instructions, it implies that the stock water use is only the water consumed by the animals. It doesn't include any other water use for misting, for cooling, within the barn, things like that. I don't think that the description of stock water in the instructions is accurate. Hopefully that gets changed, because those are some pretty direct comments from both dairy and cattle folks.
Yeah, lots of things to get ironed out. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Bill Clark, water rights expert on the legal level and the policy level down in Olympia, obviously following this all very closely and keeping us informed on what is happening. We appreciate your time and your effort to make sure that our eye is on the ball here, because it sounds like it's going to have to be. Bill, we certainly appreciate you being with us on the program this morning.
Thanks, Dylan. Happy to join.